Seriously. You have to be careful with your feelings, I think. It's a mistake to let them go just because they're summoned. But like Matilda, Clement was very good at getting his way. It wasn't too long before I gave in and let myself believe him, let myself love him back. It seemed like a sure thing. It felt just like it was supposed to. I began to think about what would happen sooner or later. I imagined the house with the spreading elm in the front yard, the sunny kitchen and the clean white linens, the children, 4 or 5 at least, with his rosy cheeks and my almond eyes. Of course, I would miss my work, but I was secretly a little pleased to see my proper course lay elsewhere. I told him about the farm and the lake. I told him how fresh and cool it all was in the summer, how clear and sparkling in the winter. I might have given the impression that every day there was a picnic because I wanted to please him. And I suppose I wanted to please myself. It was a relief to pretend that everything was just as it should be, picture perfect, waiting for me to come home. I dreamed of the summer afternoon when we would row out to my island together. I imagined him leaping from the water like a pike and how I would splash him and how he would splash me, and then how he would wrap his arms around me and pull me under the waves with him. But I should have known better, for there were clues if I'd cared to see them. One night we planned to go to Chicago, which usually meant dancing. I waited on the glider on the front porch, my hands in a sealskin muff. "Where are you off to, all dolled up?" Thea Martin asked, passing me on her way out. She had a boyfriend who lived on the next block, and he was always asking her to meet him somewhere or other, instead of picking her up like a proper date. "Oh, wherever he takes me, I guess." Whenever you told Thea where you were going, she claimed to have been somewhere better the week before. "Well, have a good time." She waved her hand behind her head as she hurried down the stairs. 2 men went in to pick up their dates, and then 5 girls came out together, all laughing, their breath making little clouds. My new cloth dancing slippers were pretty, but hardly appropriate for waiting outdoors in late October. I paced the porch a few times and then walked a few yards down the street in the direction from which Clement always came. He lived on the east side, I knew that, although I realized I didn't know where exactly. I told myself that if I went inside for a few moments, maybe ran upstairs to change my hanky, he would have come. Eliza was lying on her bed, rereading Jenny Gerhardt. "Call his office," she said. "He's probably doing a deal." She said the words, "doing a deal," disparagingly. She didn't like Clement's approach to business, the way he threw himself behind every new idea. She thought he ought to stick to one thing, tried and true. She also disapproved of the champagne. We found the number he'd given me, and I went downstairs to use the telephone. I let it ring 20 times. Then I called again and let it ring 20 more. "He's probably just down the hall," I thought. What if he answered just as I hung up? I called again and let it ring 30 times. Eliza shut her book. "Get something to eat with me." But I couldn't. How awful it would be when he showed up if I wasn't there. "Oh, you poor thing," Eliza said when she got back from her supper and found me still sitting by the window in our room. "You must be starving." "No, I had a sandwich," I lied. I took off my new shoes and put them away in the closet. "Well, I'm going to bed," she said. "There's no sense sitting up like this." Before she turned out the light, Eliza said kindly, "You probably got the date wrong." But we both knew I hadn't. When I heard her breathing deeply, I couldn't help myself. I got out of bed and went back to my chair by the window, and that's where I finally fell asleep. All that worry wasted. The next afternoon, Thea knocked on the door to our room. "Visitor for you downstairs," she said and winked. "Looks to me like someone's sorry." My cheeks went hot, and I stepped in front of the mirror for a moment. "You look fine," Eliza said without glancing up from her book. He was standing in the parlor, holding a large bunch of lavender tulips in front of his face. Those were expensive flowers in October. "I'm sorry, Amy," he said, peeking around them, pretending to be afraid of how I might look or what I might say. "It's only that I thought you might have been hurt," I said, taking the flowers from him, "or worse." Although those were not, in truth, the only possibilities I had feared. "It was an emergency," he said. "I'm an investor in a lead mine in Hazelgreen, you know, and I had to go out there to look things over. The country needs lead now. I was doing my patriotic duty." "But couldn't you have called?" "And wake the whole house. Now, you wouldn't want that. Next time, I said, I'll sit right by the phone and pick it up, first ring. Then I won't worry you've been in an accident. No, he said, I don't like the idea of your having to wait up. It isn't healthy. And you know, sometimes these meetings go so late, you can't imagine. And there isn't always a phone, Amy. That's the way my business is. I've got to go where the opportunity is. You understand that, don't you? You'll forgive me, won't you? That's a good girl. With a war on, you see, people had to do things they wouldn't otherwise. That's what I told Eliza. Why isn't he in France, she asked, if he's so crazy about patriotic duty? I knew how to answer that. One of those nights as we drove and drove, he'd told me how he tried to join more than a year before, that very first summer. Although he was nearly 40, he'd stood in line with the young fellows who could imagine nothing better to do with their youth, and the doctor had turned him away. I guess my heart's not what it should be, he said. They said it's because I had rheumatic fever once. He looked away from me, out over the dark fields as he told me this, as though it were a difficult thing to admit. It made me love him more to think that while he knew so much and could do so much, he was fragile inside. The war ended, but Clement was still busy. The next time he stood me up, he'd been doing a real estate deal in Oshkosh. You've got to stay and have a drink, or they'll think you've cheated them, he said, and he lay a dozen apricot-colored roses in my arms. What he said seemed likely enough. What did I know about business? Roses should be red, Eliza said, but what did she know about roses? Anyone can find a red rose, I said, arranging them as well as I could in my tooth cup. These are special. They bring them by train all the way from New York. I had to prop them against the wall to keep the cup from tipping over, but they made the mustard of our room seem a rich warm gold, and they lasted almost a week. The time after that, I left the porch when an hour had passed and had a bowl of soup in the drugstore, and then took myself to a movie. It was so difficult, always having to explain to Eliza. What was a night waiting here or there? It wasn't as if I had anything better to do. And he did. He had important things to do, and if, now and again, he couldn't leave them just to have a good time with me, well, how could I complain? I knew he would rather have been with me. He loved me so much, you see. That's what he said, and it made me so happy to believe it was true. And then the United States Army decided it wanted to see the vacuum box. He ran from his car up the walk that evening and bounded up the stairs. I'm in, Amy, in! He wrapped me in his arms and swung me around. The cloud of breath that issued from his mouth smelled faintly of gin. I tipped my head back and laughed. He was so excited he'd forgotten to give me the pink carnations he held. I tugged at them playfully, and he laughed too and released them. In where? I asked it so casually, expecting to hear about another partnership I wouldn't understand, another investment with the smartest fellows he'd ever met, an invention that did something I didn't know needed doing. I buried my nose in the flowers, such a sweet scent. In the army, he said. They're going to use me, send me to Washington, maybe to France. Say, I bet you can't guess why. But the war's over, I said. I sat down again on the glider, and he sat beside me. I know, it's funny, isn't it? The war's over, and now the army wants me. But you haven't guessed why, he said, and he put his arms around me and began to nuzzle my ear. Clement, I pushed him away, embarrassed. Well, aren't you going to guess? He looked hurt. I tried to make it up to him, tried to come up with some reasonable or at least amusing answer, but my head was buzzing. My fingers picked absently at the string around the flower stems. I couldn't think. I can't guess, I said finally. Tell me. They want the vacuum box. Isn't that amazing? They want to test it in Washington, and then, if they like it, I'll help them. We'll take it everywhere, all over the country, into Europe, too. I can't believe it. He was pacing back and forth on the porch now, his shoes squeaking against patches of hard-packed snow. Here, let me help you with that, he said, producing a silver pocket knife and opening the blade. But he could not hold still long enough to cut the string. He gave the knife to me and began to pace again. But I can believe it, he said, hammering the words down with conviction. I can believe it, because I know that this is a great thing, an important thing. He turned to me again, put his hands on my shoulders, and kissed me. When? When what? When do you go? In a week, There's hardly time to get everything together. He stopped then, and seemed finally to sense my mood. So, tonight, he said, you'll celebrate with me, won't you? He took my hand and pulled me gently to my feet and drew me against his coat. He pressed his mouth to my ear. It may be our last night for a long, long time. A light layer of snow made the tires hiss against the road as we drove and drove that night. When he tucked his arm around my waist, I couldn't remember why I'd never before slid tight against him. All along, I should have been holding on to him as tightly as if there were no tomorrow. We stopped at a roadhouse in Racine, where I tried my first martini, and a tavern in Kenosha, where I enjoyed my second, and another place in Winnetka, where I drank, but hardly tasted, my third. As he steered me toward the door of a plush Chicago hotel, a tall woman with almond eyes and a long, graceful neck smiled dreamily at me in the glass. Look, I said, pointing at her. So pretty. In the room, while he rang for champagne, I thought the strangest thing. This will show them, I thought. This is what happens when they leave me all alone. It almost made me cry thinking that. But then he hung up the phone and drew me to the window to look at all the lights, and I forgot that I was alone, forgot entirely. When it was over, I was frightened, sorry. I couldn't look at him, knowing what we'd done. I couldn't look at myself. I kept my eyes on the whorls of a cabbage rose patterned in the carpet. We shouldn't have, I told the cabbage rose. I kept saying it over and over, sitting there on the side of the bed, bent over a pillow clutched tight over my lap. We shouldn't have. But he draped the sheet gently over my shoulder. He was so dear. He took all the blame on himself. He loved me so, he said. He couldn't help himself, he said. Couldn't I understand that? He begged me to forgive him, and of course I did. I understood. It's all right, I said at last. Of course it's all right. We'll get married now. Tomorrow morning. Or tonight, maybe even tonight, there might be someone. You know it's impossible, he said, shaking his head sadly as he stroked my hair. Well, tomorrow morning, then. Tomorrow will certainly be all right. I thought you understood, Clement said. I thought you knew. I'm married already. Chapter 5 Clement and Teresa Owens lived with their three children in a brick house on Prospect Avenue, with high ceilings and pink globes around the new electric lights, and a door knocker shaped like an angel. Very early Sunday morning, Clement felt the smooth skin of Amanda's thigh press against his own. He awoke suddenly and threw the blanket back. "What is it?" Teresa mumbled. "Must be those stuffed peppers you made me eat last night. I told you, peppers don't sit well with me." Clement took himself downstairs to recover. Dawn found him in the kitchen, sipping coffee and staring out at the ripening day. A light was on in the big house next door, and occasionally Clement's glance would be drawn across the strip of side lawn through the hedge that separated his house from his neighbor's. He watched the neighbor's cook bend over to pull something from the oven, and felt suddenly hungry. Amy had been a mistake in the end, he thought, lighting the oven. Of course, none of them were ever pleased when he broke it off. One had laughed unpleasantly, he remembered that. A couple had railed, but most cried. He was good with tears. He wasn't hard-hearted. He felt bad for them. But they all knew as well as he did that the fun had to end sometime. Sometimes he wasn't even the one to call it off. He didn't like when that happened, but he never made a fuss. A lady had to consider her own situation. But poor Amy... thinking he would marry her? Where had she got that idea? Hadn't he been perfectly clear all along? Well, if not perfectly clear, clear enough for any reasonable person to see what was what. He sighed, feeling vaguely that she had wronged him with her expectations, and slid two thick slices of bread into the oven to toast. He'd been hoping to see her again, obviously. How else explain what he'd done? Convincing Teresa that this particular lake near this particular town was the only possible place to build a summer house? Why a summer house at all, for that matter? He swallowed some coffee and winced at the bitterness. Of course, it hadn't been like that exactly, he reminded himself, spooning sugar into his cup. He wasn't such a fool as that. He had simply gone to Nagawaki one day out of idle curiosity, or so he told himself, thinking he would take a look at the place she'd told him so much about. Nothing wrong with looking, was there? And then, well, anyone with imagination could see the possibilities. Advertising copy had run through his head, the pretty lake strung together like sapphires or nestled like robin's eggs among the green hills. In a nearby town, there was even a spa. Clement checked his toast, toffee-colored on one side, perfect. He turned the slices over and shut the oven door, careful not to make noise. The Schumachers had bought a place out there, and so had the Cooks and the Steinmans. Brewers and bankers and lumber barons were buying and building all over the area. Once he'd shown Teresa the Fieldstone mansion the Schumachers had built on Lake La Belle, she was willing to let him have the money for several choice plots, long stretches of lakefront property that up until now had been wasted on cows. Reselling this land to people who liked the idea of owning an estate, a place where they could be connected to the salt of the earth, the fresh, open air, and an aquatic playground, would be simple. He would keep some of it, some to develop, some to rent. There was no reason why only those who could afford to buy should have access to such a paradise, and he had chosen one 12-acre plot for his family. He'd got a deal on that particular site, since the slope on the property that bordered the lake was alarmingly steep, and the only spot for a house was a little too close to the water. And then, too, there were more fashionable lakes and more desirable locations even on Nagawaki itself, but those drawbacks pleased him. It never made sense to buy at the top. You made money only when you could see what others couldn't, and he could see that spread. He would put the land to work, which was another reason not to pick the sort of neighborhood where enterprise was frowned upon. He planned to do some farming, maybe produce cheese. Some people in Janesville were having excellent luck with a white cheddar, or raise Angora goats. And he planned to build an impressive house. His idea was a sort of Greek temple with white pillars rising from the wide front porch to the roof. Because of the hill, the house would have to be narrow, but that was no matter since no one could see it from the side anyway. It was the facade that counted, and the facade would be grand. He would put a white lattice gazebo on the front lawn, and friends would gather there. Men in cream-colored suits and women with parasols, their gauzy summer dresses rippling in the breeze off the lake. The architect had tried to talk him into something more modest, something retiring in browns and greens, a Swiss chalet set back in the woods, furnished in rustic pine. Perhaps, the architect had suggested, you might make some of the furniture yourself. Clement was not one to scoff at a suggestion. He liked the notion of himself sawing through the sweet-smelling wood, building fine, sturdy pieces his family would wear smooth for generations. He even went so far as to consult a man at the lumberyard who sketched a small chest and made him a list of wood and tools. And then one afternoon he took his youngest son, Arthur, into the backyard for company and managed to cut the bottom of the chest and two sides before ruining three boards and gashing his index finger. He told the architect he would not be making his own furniture and insisted on his original plan. What good was a house people couldn't see? Teresa agreed. In fact, she'd had ideas far better than the architect's to Clement's mind. She understood the purpose of the house, the way the wind had to sing through it from end to end, the way the porch had to invite picnickers in off the lake at noon and command the sunset at the cocktail hour. She'd suggested the house be three stories, with spacious attics as well. She sketched the kitchen in a separate building, connected to the dining room by a breezeway, to keep the main house cool. She insisted that they also buy two lots to the east, so as to have plenty of space for a boathouse and land for Maynard or Avis or Arthur, maybe all three, to build houses for themselves. That was the way people did it, she said. He knew what she meant by people, the kind of people who would be putting him up for their clubs. Well, all's well that ends well, Clement assured himself, spreading a thick layer of butter on his toast. If he'd never known Amanda, he'd never have found this place, this new setting that had invigorated him, made him feel like a young man full of promise all over again. The cook came into the kitchen, tying her apron around her waist. Up early again, Mr. Owens. The early bird gets the worm, Trudy. Clement took a large bite from his buttered toast as if to prove his point. Then he poured her a cup of coffee from the pot and added some to his own. Well, if it's worms you want, you'd better get out in the yard, Trudy said, pulling out the flour bin. I'm making popovers. One of these days I just might do that, Clement said. Carrying his coffee with him, he went upstairs to bathe. It was that damn vacuum box, he thought, while the water rushed into the tub. If that had been a success, his thoughts would never have gone back to Amanda. You'd think he'd never failed before, the way that disaster had got under his skin. And Teresa, he frowned at himself in the mirror, was his hair getting thin at the temples? A wife was supposed to support you, not continually remind you with patronizing sighs that it was her money you were spending, and that she'd always said this or that was a foolish risk. Amanda had not thought the vacuum box was foolish. She understood its potential, and she was a nurse, which ought to count for something. She appreciated his other projects, too. He remembered her asking about the lead mines. Did they use canaries there? She wanted to know. That was a night she squealed when the waiter brought the caviar to the table. But she'd tried it when he urged her, and she liked it when he said she should. He eased himself into the hot water, thinking what a pleasant thing it was to spend an evening with a woman like that, a woman who really believed in you. But in that dim post office, she was not at all as he'd remembered her. He would never have imagined she'd still be angry, not after more than a year, but there wasn't an ounce of friendship in the way she looked at him. She'd looked older, too, and thin in the cheeks, which was not, as he considered it now, unattractive on her. If he could have touched her face, he thought, or even her hand, it would have been better, it would have brought her back to him. But that was impossible with Teresa in the car just outside, and that woman watching from behind the counter. And what was Amy doing with that little girl? In his mind, Amanda still wore her tidy nurse's uniform all day and sat demurely on the glider of the nurse's residence at night. Through the door, Clement could hear his wife sliding the chair back from her dressing table, opening the drawer in which she kept her combs and her hat pins, preparing for morning mass. He knew just how Teresa looked, holding her back very straight as she sat before the mirror, brushing her hair deliberately. "Teresa, I'm out of soap," he called, wrapping the bar he'd been about to use in the washcloth and pushing it under his knee. "In the little table," she said, and he heard the dressing room door close behind her. Did she expect him to stand shivering and dripping in the middle of the bathroom, searching through drawers? What if he really had been out of soap? But it would serve him right if she never wanted to do anything for him again, wouldn't it? Clement began to scrub himself. The idea that he'd been chasing a woman who turned out to be a lunatic scared him a little. Well, it was over now, all of that. Teresa would see that from now on, things would again be the way they'd once been between them. "This is a lesson for me," he told himself, "a warning. From now on, I'm faithful to my wife." Saying that always made him feel optimistic. He sighed and lay back in the soothing warm water. He closed his eyes and draped a wet washcloth over his face to soften his beard. He began to think about that camera that took pictures of bones right through the skin. Couldn't that be used somehow in mining? Avis Owens, 16 years old, padded down the hall wearing the robe and slippers in which Clement had, on one recent uncomfortable morning, mistaken her for a woman. Maynard, 18, groaned, stuffed his face in his pillow, and then, in one dramatic, desperate movement, threw off his blankets and swung his bare feet onto the floor. Arthur, 6, came to full wakefulness as the water splashed into the washstand that stood against one wall of the room he shared with his brother. He stayed still with his eyes closed, listening to the hangers scraping along the rod and the dresser drawers sliding open and not being banged shut. When Maynard left the room, Arthur got out of bed and went in his pajamas to squat beside his city of blocks. He did his best work in the morning, while the bolt on the bathroom door slid open and shut, open and shut. The water rushed through the pipes. Feet galloped down and up and down the stairs. China clinked in the kitchen. And finally the front door slammed and slammed and slammed. And then, for a time, the morning's noises lulled, and the only sound in the house, as the shaft of sunlight across the bedroom floor headed steadily toward the closet, was Arthur's faintly adenoidal breathing and the dense click of the wooden blocks. Just after 8 chimes on the front room clock, his mother's slippers shuffled along the hallway floor, and then she would be standing over him, stretching her arms like a cat, and afterward retying the belt on her housecoat. Hiking the housecoat up, she'd sit on her heels beside Arthur on the floor and move blocks purposefully about, as if she knew where they were supposed to go. He let her put them wherever she wished, although of course he had to move them later. Finally, when she was bored with her efforts at play, she swooped over him with a kiss. He smelled her coffee-laced breath and her sweetly lotioned hands. At last their day would truly begin. Teresa had left the raising of Maynard and Avis, when they were young and uninteresting, to nursemaids. But Arthur was different, or perhaps she was, and she dreaded September, when he would start school, and she would no longer be able to have him with her all day. This morning, after church, they were going to pay a call on a Mrs. Herman Kessler, who'd promised to make a contribution toward the new public library. Teresa knew that people who gave money liked to see a thankful recipient rather than send their check through the anonymous post. At 62 Newbury Street, they were shown into a bright parlor where Mrs. Kessler and her friend Mrs. Jones were leafing through a sheaf of watercolors. "Look at this one," Mrs. Kessler commanded, holding for Teresa to admire a roiling seascape in which blues, greens, and grays had been mingled to form a sort of mud. "I don't know where my Charlotte gets her talent. I can't draw worth a stick, and Herman can hardly sign his name." "It's lovely," Teresa said. "Remarkable," Mrs. Jones concurred. "The way she's captured the feeling," Mrs. Kessler said, holding the painting at arm's length and squinting in an attempt to bring some aspect, any aspect, of the picture into focus. "That's the mark of a true artist." Teresa politely agreed. And then, since she'd met Mrs. Kessler and Mrs. Jones when they were serving on several Red Cross committees during the war, they discussed when they'd last seen and when they'd last heard about this woman and that, and laughed about the day they'd shoveled 300 pounds of peach pits for the gas masks, while Arthur had nothing to do but take a cookie whenever it was offered and turn the pages of a picture book he'd brought along. "You know, I think we saw your daughter last week at the Milwaukee Turners," Mrs. Jones said finally to Teresa. "Do I remember rightly that her name is Avis?" Arthur began to listen then. It always seemed strange to him that people he'd never seen before should know his sister and brother. "How good of you to remember," Teresa said. "She was with another young lady," Mrs. Kessler said. "A girl with an unfortunate nose." "Meta Kunkel, yes. It's really too bad about her nose." "I'm sure she's a lovely girl," Mrs. Kessler said, with the complacency of one whose daughter's nose was straight and neat. "She's not a girl I would choose as a friend for Avis, but one's children don't always do just what one would like, do they?" Teresa thought Maida was awkward, loud, and humorless, and unlikely to attract the sort of people she wished Avis would associate with. In particular, she wanted Avis to show more interest in the young men of her social circle. It upset her to see her daughter, with so many opportunities and so much talent, although Avis had never seen a body of water larger than Lake Michigan, her seascapes really did capture the sense of the ocean, squander her chances for happiness. Still, Teresa comforted herself, Avis could be quite pretty when she got herself up. Surely she would grow into a more appropriate attitude. Mrs. Kessler sipped her tea and didn't answer, but her look above her teacup was pitying and smug. "Maynard," Teresa said, "my older son, has got a very good position. He's with the First Bank, you know, and the things they have him do. Really, it makes me nervous sometimes to think of all that money." Of course, Maynard did not yet have any real responsibility. He mostly carried papers from one office to another for bank officers to sign. But they were very important papers, and the vice president was always assuring him that he would go far. "So he's not going to college," Mrs. Kessler said, biting a lady's finger carefully so the powdered sugar wouldn't fly. "Well, no, he didn't see the point. You see, he worked at the bank as an errand boy in the summers, and when he graduated from St. John's, they offered him this job right away. I'm not saying he needs the education. Goodness knows my Freddie came out of Yale as stupid as he went in. But it's the friends you make, the society. You can't expect him to get ahead unless he knows the right people." "Probably he'll go to college in a year or two," Teresa said rashly. "I wouldn't be surprised." A significant look passed between Mrs. Kessler and Mrs. Jones, whose son would be a junior at the U of C that fall, and Teresa could see that she had somehow shown herself to a disadvantage. Mrs. Jones opened a fresh subject. "I understand you're building a summer place." "Yes," Teresa answered warily. What would they make of a too narrow house on a too steep slope on the wrong side of the wrong lake? Oh, I wish I could convince Herman to do that, Mrs. Kessler said. You can't get away from the smell of the river here in the summertime. It's simply unbearable. But he won't leave the city. You miss too many opportunities, he says, when you're away. That's all very well for him, but what opportunities would I miss? He doesn't give a thought to Charlotte. She doesn't see why she should have to stay in town, especially when all of her friends go. If we must stay, we have to have a place on Lake Michigan, I tell Herman, but he won't do that either. This house was good enough for my father, he says, and it's good enough for me. So here we are, completely dependent on the good graces of relatives and friends who have summer places. She smiled at Teresa. We would love to have you stay with us as soon as the house is ready, Teresa said. We'll be joining the yacht club and the tennis club, and I know Avis and Maynard would be delighted to take Charlotte with them to the various functions. In fact, Avis was dead set against joining any club she judged hoity-toity, and Maynard had never managed to get the knack of tennis. But Teresa trusted that these minor hitches would solve themselves once she got her family into a new setting, where their true personalities had room to flower. She was counting on this house also to rectify one major problem, the waywardness of her husband. Already she could see a change in Clement. He arrived home promptly every evening so that they could pore over the blueprints together. He described his plans to her with the same excitement he'd shown when they were first courting, and he was eager to hear how she'd received them. And he knocked on her bedroom door frequently. Yes, he'd certainly come back to her, and she was convinced that this new project, for which he welcomed her ideas as well as her money, just as he'd done in the early days, would keep him close. Later, when Teresa paused on the steps of the Kessler's house and released Arthur's hand so that she could fold the check and slip it into her purse, she decided that the visit had been satisfactory overall. That the house was all right was a particular relief. She hadn't been sure before this. Clement had been sure, but then he was positive about every one of his schemes. His enthusiasm meant nothing. But Florence Kessler wouldn't approve just anything, nor would Alice Jones. Now Teresa felt free to imagine her family there, Arthur pushing a toy sailboat along the shore with a stick, his knees grass-stained and his hair grown sweetly shaggy, Maynard at the tiller of a real sailboat, squinting up at the bright white canvas, maybe even winning a regatta and then presenting her with the silver cup. Avis sitting with a nice boy, a friend of Maynard, perhaps, in the gazebo the final hour of Sunday evening, enjoying the agony of the thought that they wouldn't see each other again for at least a week. And she and Clement? Too soon, she thought. She didn't dare count on it. But she kept the notion warm, like a seed beneath the frost line. At 4 o'clock each day, Teresa and Arthur took a nap together on the cool satin comforter that covered her bed. Before they fell asleep, each would lie listening to the quiet, steady breathing of the other, watching the afternoon shadows slowly stain the ceiling. Sometimes Arthur would rest his head on Teresa's stomach and wonder at the continuous gurgle that no one but he could hear. At 5:30, Arthur went out to sit on the stone front steps to wait for Clement to come home. He couldn't be dissuaded from this duty, even in the worst weather. When it rained or hailed, he stood close to the house, under the overhang that protected the front door. When it was sunny or snowy, he amused himself while he waited by jumping from step to step. Sometimes he ranged over the entire yard, using the steps only as a base. Always, though, he kept the street strictly in sight, for he worried that if he did not, his father might not come safely home. And he knew his father ought to come home, even though he sometimes wished he wouldn't. Chapter 6. On the advice of Pastor Jensen, Carl had arranged for Hilda Grossman, a second cousin once removed on his father's side, to come from Tomahawk to do the housework and keep an eye on Ruth while Amanda was at St. Michael's. Hilda had made clear that she was not entirely pleased with the arrangement. "I'll say it straight out, Carl," she said, dropping her carpet bag so that it fell at her feet with a thump. "I know there was something funny going on in this house. You might think we're ignorant up in Tomahawk, but we hear things. Another one mightn't have come. But you're in a fix, and family's family, so here I am. She crossed her arms over the hills of her bosom and waited for him to answer. What do you mean, something funny?
I don't know, but I do know that a decent woman doesn't hide on an island for months not speaking to another soul. And I also know that a decent woman drowns in broad daylight, when everyone can see what's what, not in secret in the middle of the night. That's what I know.
Carl narrowed his eyes as if trying to sharpen his vision. I don't understand. What are you driving at?
I'm not saying anything more. Gossip is wicked. That's how I was taught. I just wanted to make my position clear.
But she'd only made things more murky for Carl. What had happened while he'd been away? He should have pressed Amanda when he'd had the chance. Asking her now was out of the question. That night in his room, Carl searched the photograph of Matilda that stood on his nightstand. He picked it up by the frame and shook it, trying what? To make her speak? To change her expression? She smiled on, looking as if she meant to live forever. For the first week or two after Amanda went away, Ruth was restless. She wandered from room to room, stopping to stare out of every low-silled window. She picked up objects as she went, light, little things, her blanket, her bear, a spoon, a stocking from Amanda's drawer, and she dropped them absently along her way, so that by the end of the day the house was strewn with litter. And she cried, although really the sound was more of a whimper, a weak keening that seemed to hover at the base of her throat, spilling out at the least provocation, and often with no provocation at all, and was unstaunchable once begun. Once or twice Hilda patted her lap and held out her arms to the little girl. "Come to Hilda now," she said, smiling reassuringly at Carl. But Ruth turned away, would not even come close. Hilda, embarrassed, seemed to close her heart against Ruth then. "There's no pleasing some people," she said, standing abruptly and brushing her lap away. Carl held Ruth and rocked her, but never for long. She slipped from his arms and out of his lap like quicksilver, and he was unable to arrest her drift until she fell asleep in some corner, exhausted. And then, one day at breakfast, she held out her glass in both hands. "What do you say?" he prompted, lifting the milk pitcher. When she said nothing, only thrust her glass forward again, he realized that he hadn't heard her speak a word in days. "Ruthie, what do you say?" he repeated more sternly this time. Still, she said nothing. "I'd like some milk, please," he said. Ruth gave the table one smart rap with the bottom of her glass. "That's enough, Ruthie." He set the pitcher back on the table and reached to take the glass out of her hands. It was impossible to say, really, what happened next. Did she drop it deliberately or only release her hold before his grip was firm? In any case, the glass hit the floor with a crash. Hilda came down to breakfast as he was sweeping up. "Ruth doesn't get anything today unless she asks for it properly, Hilda," he said, dumping the shards into the wastebasket. "She knows how to talk." "I understand," Hilda answered, pouring coffee into her cup as if the kitchen were her own. She seemed almost pleased, Carl thought, at the chance to punish Ruth, and it made him think better of his words. "I don't mean you should starve her." Hilda looked at him thoughtfully and took a sip of her coffee. "You let females walk all over you, Carl, you know that? Even this little thing here. You don't do her no favors, letting her have her way." Her talking like that made him angry, but maybe she was right, about Ruth, anyway. What did he know about raising a little girl? He worried about her, losing two mamas. No wonder she wasn't acting right. But what could he do about it? Hilda knew best, he thought. He hoped, as he hurried out to the barn. At noon, Hilda made a cheese sandwich and held it out to Ruth on a plate. When the little girl reached for it, Hilda lifted it high. "What do we say?" Ruth began to whimper. "Crocodile tears won't get you nowhere with me, young lady." Hilda took a bite out of the sandwich and chewed it deliberately as Ruth began to shriek. Hilda set the sandwich down and rummaged through a drawer. When she turned to face Ruth again, she was holding a wooden spoon. "I'll give you something to cry about." She grabbed Ruth by the arm and landed three or four good smacks on Ruth's bottom. "That'll learn you." She picked Ruth up around the waist, carried her upstairs, deposited her in her room, and shut the door. Hilda made supper for them every night, usually boiled potatoes and some piece of meat, cooked until it had relinquished the very last of its juices. "She isn't even properly trained," she complained, spreading mustard onto her potato with her knife. "What do you mean, trained in what?"
Carl usually kept his head down as they ate, so as not to have to watch her chew, but he looked up now, puzzled. You know, trained. When Carl, still uncomprehending, shook his head, Hilda blushed and lowered her eyes. You know, she wets herself. It was such a relief to see Hilda looking that way, disconcerted, unformidable, that Carl laughed, and amazingly, Hilda laughed too. It's nothing to laugh at, she protested, but she was still smiling. For a few brief moments they looked at each other, struck by the difference, but neither knew how to go on. Well, what do we do about it? Carl asked finally. I guess I know how to train a child. Hilda's training method consisted of not allowing Ruth to change her panties when she wet them, and of course that meant she wasn't allowed to sit down anywhere in the house. You have to learn to live with your mistakes, Hilda said. Ruth took to hiding her wet underthings and wearing nothing under her skirt for the rest of the day. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, Carl, Hilda said, meeting him at the back door the day she discovered Ruth's trick. But a normal child, a decent child, doesn't run around naked. You can see she wasn't brung up right. It's no wonder the sister's in the nut house, and it makes you wonder about the mother, too. I'm sorry to say it, but it does. She did not seem sorry to say it. She seemed pleased, triumphant. Carl was outraged. You have no right to say such things about my wife or my wife's family. If that's the way you feel, you can go back to Tomahawk. I'll give you the money for your ticket. Hilda seemed surprised by his anger. And leave you alone with a child like this? I think I know my duty better than that. She turned then, abruptly, and went into the kitchen and busied herself among the pans. Carl put his jacket back on and took himself back out to the barn, although he had already decided he was through for the day, and began to soap Frenchie's bridle. How dare she, he thought, say such things about Matilda, about her family? She was only a jealous spinster, trying to cause trouble for another woman, a happy woman, a woman who'd had a husband who loved her. He rubbed the bridle hard until the rag he was using slipped and the friction of his fingers against the leather burned his skin. Why couldn't a woman just drown? People drowned all the time, that's what Amanda had said. Amanda, who couldn't tie her own shoes now. But that had nothing to do with it, he assured himself. Of course people drowned. It didn't mean there was something wrong, something to be wondered about. The doubt gnawed at him, though. Doubt about what exactly he couldn't say. If only he could speak to Matilda just for a few minutes. If only he could see her, then, he thought, he would know. He would be reassured. But his memory of her had continued to soften around the edges. Sometimes he was disturbed to realize that he was remembering not her, but the way she'd posed for a photograph he'd studied the day before. And so, perhaps Hilda, while not knowing anything for certain, how could she know anything for certain, sensed something that he was too dull to perceive. Ruth began to smash things. She poked at the flower pots on the porch railing with a stick until they crashed on the slates below. She pushed the milk pitcher off the table. She dropped her grandmother Starkey's collection of Mexican glass animals one by one onto the hearthstone. She tore pages out of books and ripped the stereograph pictures in two. She sawed the edge of the kitchen table with a butter knife. Horrible, horrible child! Although Hilda came as fast as she could the moment she heard a bang or a crash, she was seldom quick enough to get a good grip on Ruth, who scuttled away, half running, half sliding down the stairs into the cellar, where she crouched in the space under the laundry sink, pressed tightly against the wall next to the bleach and the lye. The fingers flailed before her, clawing for a hold on her scalp and then slapping about wildly in frustration. Hilda did not go easily to her knees. She bent before the cupboard, one hand clutching the sink for support, the other groping blindly in the dark recesses. Her breasts and her legs planted wide, blocked escape with a wall of flowered yellow. Finally, she rearranged her weight and shoved her shoulder in more deeply to extend her reach until she could grab a bit of Ruth's skirt or a handful of her hair. Then she'd drag her, howling, out and up the stairs to the drawer with the wooden spoon. When Carl came in, Hilda met him at the door with a paper sack of broken pieces so often that he began to wonder what fragile thing could possibly be left in the house to destroy. The only variation to this pattern came on a wet afternoon, when for a moment Hilda's hand, groping for Ruth beneath the sink, paused in midair. That day Ruth bit, relishing the living flesh between her teeth, the slightly salty tang of the skin. For a shimmering half-moment, the house was silent. Hilda stared at her hand in surprise, and then she screamed like a peacock. She held out her bandaged hand as soon as Carl reached the porch. "You better know," she said. "You're raising a wild animal." Carl felt guilty. He tried to make it up to Hilda by being extra polite himself, by not interfering in the way she treated Ruth, by moving her things into the best bedroom. What would they do if she left them? Carl stood just inside the door of the common room at St. Michael's, wishing his sister-in-law would pull herself together. Amanda had moved her chair, turning her back on the room, so that she could stare into the woods where the snow clung stubbornly, refusing to give way to the spring. She had been in the sanatorium for nearly a year. Her hands were busy, the fingers of one working at the thumb of the other, a habit he'd noticed lately. He could see that someone had encouraged her to dress herself, the policy when a patient was well enough, for her skirt was twisted and her blouse misbuttoned. Her hair, curly and inclined to wildness, a quality he had once thought rather nice, looked, well, like a lunatic's. "Amanda?" he said, and she jumped, separating her hands and letting her arms hang limply at her sides. She turned to him and nodded gravely. "Hello, Carl. And how have you been keeping yourself?" "Oh, fine, fine," he said, seating himself on the neighboring chair and reaching over to squeeze her hand. She allowed him to do this, but did not return his gentle pressure. "Don't you want to fix yourself up a little?" he asked. Amanda touched her bodice and her hair as if surprised to learn that she was not completely presentable. "Well, I suppose," she faltered, I have no mirror, you know," she said accusingly. "I can be a help to you then," Carl said softly. "The buttons aren't right." He began, reaching a hesitant finger toward her, first at a place toward the middle of her stomach where the fabric was skewed, and then, thinking better of that, touching the stray corner of cloth that jutted too high around her neck. "They've hidden my slippers again, as you can see," she said, holding her stocking feet out to prove it. Seeing her long, thin feet and skinny ankles stuck out like that seemed almost worse, more embarrassingly intimate than seeing the sliver of camisole through her misbuttoned blouse. While Carl cast his eyes down and searched under the chairs for her slippers, Amanda discreetly redid her buttons. "That's better," he said, settling her cardigan over her shoulders. He wished he could smooth her hair a little while he stood there behind her, but he wasn't brave enough to touch it. And anyway, what would he do? He had no idea how women did what they did to their hair. "Well, I don't want to keep you now," she said when he'd finished. "Oh, you're not keeping me at all." He leaned back in his chair and crossed his legs comfortably. It was nice to be there, away from Ruth not talking and Hilda talking so much. He could see why she wanted to stay. "I know you've got to be getting home," she said more firmly this time. So he sighed and rose from his chair. He told her that he would be back the next day, unless he had to wait for the farrier, in which case he would come the next. When he was gone, she tipped her head back against the chair, so that the tears that filled her eyes would not spill over. Amanda. "I told you to go back, Maddie. I told you that. I told you. Why won't you ever mind me? You were trouble from the day you were born. You don't remember it, but I do. All that crying and crying in the night, so much crying that Mama and Papa couldn't stand it. They put your cradle in with me. You don't remember, but I sang to you. I rubbed your back. I lifted you up and bounced you on my lap. I brought you into my bed and tucked your head under my chin. But still you couldn't rest. I fell asleep to your wailing, and it raged like a storm through my dreams. You wouldn't remember that. And then that first summer you got quiet, so quiet, like a doll lying there in your crib, and fierce red spots bloomed all over your body. Papa made up the daybed for me in the back room downstairs. He forbade me to go upstairs where you and Mama were, for fear of contagion, I know now, although I didn't then. I tried to keep to a regular schedule, tried to wash my face and my teeth when I got up in the morning and before I went to bed at night. I wandered around the yard and the barn all day, or laid my paper dolls out on the floor. Sometimes the hired girl remembered to make me a sandwich. Otherwise, at dinner time, I stood on a stool to reach the crackers down from the cupboard. I dipped the broken ones, the ones nobody would miss, in a jar of blackberry jam. Morning, noon, and night, I could hear Mama crooning beside your cradle. One afternoon I must have fallen asleep because the hot sun slanting across my face woke me. My hair stuck in the jam smeared across my cheek. I felt exhausted, hot, and hungry. And something was wrong. I could hear nothing, no sound at all, from the room overhead. I made my way up the stairs one silent step at a time, ready to run down the moment I heard Mama's shoes on the landing or Papa's hand at the door. At the top of the stairs I could see into the bedroom where you lay, all alone and still. I went in. I laid my hand on your tiny brow. It was as hot as a loaf right out of the oven. And then Mama came at me. "Don't touch her! Don't you touch her! Get out of here this instant!" I hardly recognized her, her hair flying every way, her shirt waist stained, not the neat, pretty Mama I knew. I snatched my hand away and ran out of the room, down the stairs, out the back door. I ran across the yard and into the woods. The brambles clawed my skin, but I clamped my teeth together and did not cry. The slim branches slapped against my cheeks, but I ran on. I ran until I came to the edge of the lake. The water was flat and green. It lay like a smooth path from where I stood to a burst of trees and rocks at its middle, the island. Out there the sun fell full on lush leaves so that the place glowed. I wandered along the shore, catching my breath, keeping my eye on the island. Had I known how, I would have thrown myself into the water and swum to it. And then I came upon a boat, a small wooden rowboat. Its robin's egg blue paint nearly rubbed away. Its bow rested in the mud. Its stern floated free, so that even I, with my puny strength, could pry it loose from the shore. I climbed in, picked up one of the oars, and used it as a pole to push myself into the deep water. And then I paddled away, away, to my island. That was the first time I escaped to that place. I believed everything would be all right there, you see. I thought so then. I thought so later. But later I was wrong. "Well, Carl, how was she?" Hilda asked, passing him a bowl of pickled beets. Carl shook his head. "Not so good, I think." Hilda nodded. She took a large bite from her buttered bread and then, with exaggerated daintiness, dabbed the crumbs from her lips with a corner of her napkin and smoothed some stray hairs behind her ear. Carl noticed for the first time a coquettish tilt to her head, and he cleared his throat nervously. "Ruthie's behaving better, I noticed," he said. "Oh, Ruth and I get along good nowadays, don't we, Ruth?" Hilda reached to pat Ruth's head with a stiff hand, but Ruth ducked her touch. "She's a good little helper," Hilda went on, pretending she'd only meant to retrieve a few peas that had rolled from the girl's plate onto the oilcloth. "I wouldn't be surprised if she's beginning to think I'm her mama." She gave Carl a sort of dreamy smile that made him push his chair from the table and gulp the remainder of his coffee standing up. "Gotta take a ride into town. Running out of, But he was out the door before he'd finished the sentence. Ruth had stopped breaking things after the night she dropped a pocket watch over the railing at the top of the stairs. "This was my papa's," her father had said to her, stroking the shattered face with his thumb, and then he covered his own face with his hands until Ruth was frightened and climbed onto his knee to pull those hands away. She watched Hilda often now, quietly shadowing her at a distance of about 5 feet and copying her walk, the angle of her head, the weary gesture she used to push the hair off her forehead with the back of her hand. That afternoon she sat on the rug in Hilda's room, observing Hilda at her simple toilet. "A little attention to appearance can make a big difference," Hilda said, eyeing Ruth's reflection in her mirror, while she patted cream on her flat cheeks with her fingertips. "Here," she said, taking from a drawer the corset she wore only on Sundays under her church clothes. "Are your hands clean? Feel this." Ruth ran one careful finger along the edge. "Real Belgian lace," Hilda said. "See how fine it is? That's the highest quality you can buy." "And this here is to make your face nice," she explained, taking a tiny pot of rouge and a red lipstick from the back of a drawer. Once she'd shown the effect to Ruth and examined it herself in the mirror, she carefully wiped all traces of paint away before leaving the room. "I invited some ladies," Carl said that evening as he stomped his feet on the back porch. Hilda, standing guard to be sure he shed his muddy boots, narrowed her eyes and tried to peer behind him, as if she expected half a dozen women to be clustered on the lawn. What are you talking about?
I thought you might be lonely way out here, so I invited some ladies over to the house next week, he said as casually as he could manage. Avoiding her look, he turned to hang his jacket neatly on its hook. Kind of a party, I guess.
Carl, you didn't! She blocked his way into the kitchen, her hands on her hips. What, did I do something wrong? Wouldn't you like to have a little company? I run all over Kingdom Come after that child. I break my back over the housework every day. And now you want me to have a party?
I just thought you'd like, you know, to see some people. Your mother had the ladies over every Thursday, I remember.
Wednesday. And what do you expect me to do with these people I hardly know?
I don't know what ladies do, Carl shrugged. Play cards, I guess. Drink coffee, eat cake.
Cake? You want me to bake? And there ain't hardly 3 matching cups in this house.
Well, Carl said, slipping past her. All right, I'll tell them tomorrow never mind coming.
And then they'll think I can't manage company. No, the damage is done.
She sighed heavily and returned to the stove where she vigorously stirred with a wooden spoon a substance that had begun to explode in angry bubbles. Throughout that week, she sent Carl on at least one trip to town a day to buy special items, like fresh playing cards and cute little pads of paper, and quarter-length pencils from Backy's, and nuts and dried fruit and sugar in cubes from Mr. Pucci. She hired Tecla Manigold, one of Mary Louise's young sisters, to help out for the afternoon, and directed Rudy to burrow through the attic for card tables. For 3 evenings in a row, supper conversation consisted primarily of Hilda's debate with herself over buying a fancy layer cake with pink and yellow roses from Klein's, or baking her own much-admired and tomahawk, Stolen. She even sewed one of her best handkerchiefs to a ribbon to make Ruth a tiny apron and made her practice walking extra carefully around the room, stopping before each chair to offer the cream pitcher and sugar bowl on a silver tray. If this is a nice party, she told Ruth, I wouldn't be surprised if we wanted to start a club. My mother and I belong to 3 card clubs in Tomahawk, you know.
Carl, Hilda said the evening before the event, you'll come in, won't you?
She kept her eyes on the applesauce she was spooning onto her plate.
Just for a half hour or so, 20 minutes. I know everyone'd want to see you, and Ruth's been working so hard on the serving, she added.
Carl looked at his daughter. She hadn't caused any trouble for weeks, months even, but still she wouldn't speak. He wished she would cause trouble. There was at least some noise, some expression in that. But what could he do? You couldn't make a child talk. You couldn't even make her break things. He made a show of chewing his meat, stalling for time. He knew Hilda wanted him for her own sake, not for Ruth's, but what was half an hour? Surely he could be gallant for that little time to please her. She was taking care of his daughter, after all, as well as she knew how. And if that wasn't very well, he realized it wasn't altogether her fault. He'd known his cousin as a child in Tomahawk, and he reminded himself that she could hardly have helped growing into the hard and unpleasant woman she'd become. She'd almost been born that way.
All right, I'll come in, he said to Hilda.
What time?
Oh, let's say 4 o'clock, Hilda beamed. Give people time to settle down.
The next morning, Hilda hurried everyone through breakfast. By dinner time, the Stolen was frosted, the cushions plumped, the clean antimacassars smoothed, and the teaspoons polished and examined for fingerprints. To save time and to keep the kitchen clean, she'd made only cold sandwiches for the noon meal.
I know you have better things to do than sit around here waiting for a bunch of hens, she said when Carl and Rudy seemed inclined to linger over their coffee.
They drained their cups dutifully and pushed their chairs back.
You're not forgetting, Hilda said to Carl at the door. And you'll put on a clean shirt.
I'm not forgetting, he assured her, while he swung Ruth into the air once or twice. He gave the girl a little push between the shoulders to send her on her way. You be good now. Hilda went into the bathroom in her slip, and Ruth watched her sponge soap and water under her arms and around her neck. She watched Hilda's hair, charged with 100 strokes, rise into the air as it reached for the brush and then, under Hilda's artful fingers, coil like a sweet roll behind the woman's head. Wedged between the wardrobe and the wall, Ruth watched Hilda take her corset from the wardrobe, slide her arms through the straps, pucker her lips and blow until she'd squeezed all the air from her lungs.
Her fingers strained to pull the sides together over her waist and ribs. 1, 2, 3 hooks done. She took a small, shallow breath and pushed even that air out again. 4. And then they heard a ripping sound. Hilda stopped breathing. The sound ceased. She breathed again, and there it was. One of the seams was giving way. Quickly, Hilda loosened the hooks to ease the strain. "No, no, no, don't let this happen," she whispered. But it had happened. The damage was done. Up one side was a long tear, and there was no time to repair it. She sank to the bed and sat for a moment or two, her head bowed. Then she straightened her shoulders, slipped the corset off her arms, and dropped it on the bed. "It's a lucky thing," she said to Ruth. "I listened to my mama and spent my money on quality when I bought this dress. It fits fine, even without a foundation, don't you think?" She turned sideways in front of the mirror, sucked her stomach in, and smoothed the fabric over it. "It'll have to do," she said. "No one's wearing these bulky things anyway nowadays. I heard Mrs. Lindgren say so just the other week." Hilda leaned close to the mirror and examined her face. "Just the teeniest dot of color," she declared, pressing her finger into the rouge pot and then massaging the paint in a little circle into each pasty cheek. "Well," she said, turning toward Ruth, her cheeks a dramatic scarlet from the rough rubbing, "how do I look?" Ruth pressed her palms to her own rosy face. Hilda frowned. "I bet you think you're something," she said. "What's that on your dress, mustard? Well, you can't wear that now. Hurry up. I don't have all day." But there was still plenty of time, and when Tekla arrived half an hour before the guests were due, Hilda and Ruth were ready and waiting, sitting at the kitchen table so as not to muss the cushions in the front room. At 3:20, Clara Guntenkunst and Ida Brummer knocked at the door, and soon after that the rest of the ladies appeared, so that by 3:30, the appointed hour, the entire party was assembled. Tekla, carrying coats, ran lightly up and down the stairs, and Hilda ushered the ladies in and sat them down around the room. There was to be some general conversation before they got down to the cards, and then, after the first hand, refreshments. It was a little awkward at the very first, as such things are, with the women uncertain about whether they ought to be addressing every comment to the room at large, or only to the one or two seated nearby. Still, this quickly sorted itself out, and as they were all well acquainted, they didn't lack for conversation, especially since one particular topic held great interest for nearly all of them. Although some asked quite forward questions and craned their necks to take in as much of the house as possible, and others only waited, smiling politely, to hear Hilda's answers, there was hardly a one who was not morbidly curious to see what had become of the place, after all the tragedy this house has seen, and to hear about Amanda. Of course one had to be delicate. This was, after all, her own house. And then there was Mary Louise to consider, since they were such friends. Nevertheless, pockets of gossip buzzed here and there all around the room. "I understand she cut off all her hair. They needed 5 men to drag her out of the house. Tried to drown the little girl, that's what I heard. Oh, that poor motherless child." Abruptly and rather loudly, Hilda said, "Shall we play cards?" She was already snapping the legs of one of the folding tables into place. "Oh, yes, let's play," Mary Louise seconded. "How would you like us to sit?" asked Leota Prunerstorfen, and those who had been about to pull chairs to the tables any old way hesitated. "Oh," said Hilda, and looked blankly around the expectant group. "I hadn't really thought." "I think Hattie might head up the first table, don't you, Hilda?" Mary Louise said, and Hattie Jensen, one of the eldest women there and wife of the pastor, nodded and graciously stepped to her accustomed place. "And then Dolly, the second, and Albertina over here, I think." And she went on, as she knew Amanda would have liked, ably sorting the women into 2 congenial groups, as if she were arranging flowers. Hilda withheld the stiff packs of new cards until everyone was seated, and then ceremoniously handed one to Hattie Jensen and brought the other to her own table. They were well into their first hand when, above the noise, the kitchen door opened and closed. "Just a moment," Hilda said. Her cheeks suddenly flushed, and she left her place at the table and hurried into the kitchen. Rudy had come in with Carl and stood awkwardly in the doorway, holding his hat. Softly, shyly, when Hilda was close, he said, "You look very pretty." Hilda looked at him severely and then turned away to take Carl's arm and draw him with her into the front room. You all know Carl, of course, she sang out with unnatural gaiety that made the other women glance at one another over their cards. A murmur of how do you do's rose from the two tables. With his diffident manner, Carl was charming, they all agreed, and they knew he'd been bravely wounded in the war, although Clara and Ida remembered that he'd only been a meat packer when poor Matilda married him. You'll stay for refreshments, won't you, Carl? Why don't we have them now? Hilda suggested, which made Hattie Jensen raise her eyebrows, for they were in the middle of a hand, and she seemed likely to win. Hilda went to the kitchen door. Tekla, we're ready for our coffee. Sure, the girl said. I'll bring it right in. She closed her magazine and went to the icebox for the cream. Where's Ruth? Hilda looked around the kitchen and leaned down to peer under the sink.